are listening to a message from Stonegate Church. For more information about Stonegate and additional audio resources, please visit stonegate.church.
The transition from one year to the next is one of those obvious moments in our life where it prompts us to look back and do some reflection. And I hope you've given some time to do that. It prompts us to look back and observe, like, here are the ways that God has met me over the last year. Here's the way he has provided. Here's the way his care has shown up in my life. It gives you a chance to look back and through the many circumstances in your life that you've lived through over the last year and what the Lord has been up to you, up to in your life. It gives you a chance to look back and get a sense of what is God teaching you in this season and what is it that he's wanting to show you. So a new year gives us a chance to do that work of looking back. And a new year also gives us a chance to look forward. To let our hearts fill with anticipation and hope and some vision for what it is that God might want to do in our future. And as we do that work of looking forward, many people make New Year resolutions. I don't know if you're a resolution guy. I kind of hope you are. I think it's a good habit to get into, just to allow your heart to dream a bit with the Lord about what new things need to be added into your life, what new skills need to be developed, what new habits need to be created in your life. And I've chuckled this week on New Year's Day, a friend of mine shot me this picture. It's going to show up on the screen behind me because this is often how our resolutions go, right? Day one, it's really great. Day two, we're on the struggle bus. Day four, we have just given up and we're sleeping, right? This is how many of those resolutions go. But in all seriousness, I think they are a good thing. I think you should do that. I think you should, with the Lord, make commitments of the next year of the things that you want to grow in and develop in and you want to do. And so as we start 2026, I want to explore one verse from the book of Proverbs that is not meant to be a New Year resolution in your life. It's not meant to be a one-year resolution in your life. It's really meant to be a whole life resolution. This verse is meant to be the work for the rest of your life, the resolution for the rest of your life, the thing that you're doing for the rest of your life. That's what this one particular verse is meant to be, a whole life resolution. And here is that verse. Proverbs 4, verse 23. Proverbs 4, verse 23. Above all else, keep your heart, for everything you do flows from it. This is the work of a Christian. This is what a Christian is giving their life to. Not for a year, but for the whole of their life. Can you just say this verse with me? Above all else, keep your heart, for everything you do flows from it. I would so commend you memorizing Proverbs 4, verse 23. It is one of those verses that I think every Christian needs to have kind of tucked into their back pocket, just sort of stuffed into their heart so they have it on easy recall. Here is the whole life resolution of a Christian. Above all else, keep your heart, for everything you do flows from it. Now, I want to ask two questions of this verse. Here's the first one. What is the heart? It's obvious that if we're going to do this work of keeping our heart, we have to first know what the heart is. When the Bible uses that word heart, what is it talking about? What is the heart? Now, the word heart is a massive word in the Bible. If you just start reading from Genesis to Revelation, you're going to come across that word over 900 times. So anytime the Bible is dedicating that kind of real estate to a word, we should probably think about that word a little bit. Make sure we have a good understanding of that word. It is an important word in the Bible. And if you want an easy way of just kind of getting a sense of what the heart is, this would be an easy way to think about it. The heart is the source inside of us from which all of our actions flow. That's the heart. It's that thing in you, that the real you, the inner you, the source inside of us from which all our actions flow. When the Bible is talking about the heart, it's really talking about the real you. The inner you. You're made of like a body and you're made of an inner you, and that inner you is what the Bible is referring to with that word heart. So if you think about the heart as this circle, okay, think about what all that circle now contains. The heart is the category that contains in the Bible your mind or your thinking. So when you get alone and you're thinking about a thing, the Bible sees you doing that in your heart. That is a heart action, your mind, your thoughts, your reasoning. This is why the Bible in Mark 2:6 says, now some of the scribes were questioning, or they were thinking in their hearts. That thinking, questioning, reasoning thing that you do, that is a heart action. It's in this circle called the heart in the Bible. Your emotions, the way you feel about things, that is in the Bible inside of this thing called the heart. It's all happening in the heart. We have language to even talk about that. When we say, she broke my heart, that is, we're using heart language to talk about being sad. So the Bible even uses this sort of a language where it'll say, why is your heart sad? Right? Because inside of this thing called the heart are our emotions, joy and sadness and everything else that kind of fills our emotional life. But it also, inside of this thing called the heart, is our will. It's where we decide what it is that we're going to do. It's we're going to make decisions and we're going to start doing things in our life. All of those decisions are made from the heart, the Bible says. So it's your mind inside of this thing called the heart. It's your emotions, your will, and your affections. And this is really foundational to what's happening inside of your heart, like the real you, the inner you. Deep down in the contours of your heart, at the bottom level are desires, wants, longings, loves. That's all of that stuff is happening inside of your heart. So you could think about the heart as the control center of your life. Or you could think about the heart as the steering wheel of your life. It's that source inside of us from which all of our actions flow. This is why Proverbs 4:23 says, everything we do flows from it. Right? This is the heart in the Bible. Now listen to the way Jesus talks about the heart and how all of these things in our life flow out of our heart, that Christianity really is an inside-out way of seeing the world. So he says it like this in Mark chapter 7. He says, for from within, so in here, out of the heart of man. So now we're in that category of the heart, the inside you, the real you, the inner you. For from within, out of the heart of man comes evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these things come from within and they defile a person. So what Jesus is teaching us is kind of that fruit or root to fruit principle. That you have a root, and from that root grows fruit. This is what he's showing us here. He is saying that this bad fruit, so evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, all these bad things, they're not coming up in a person's life because of bad circumstances, as bad as they may be. That bad fruit, all these bad things in that text, are not coming up because bad people are in a person's life, as bad as those people might be. That's not the reason that bad fruit grows in our life. Jesus is saying the problem is not out there in our life. The problem is in here. The problem is a heart problem. Bad hearts produce bad fruit. And so, this is the reason that in the scriptures we see a God who is after the heart of people. If you think about what God is going after in your life, here's a way to think about it. Your heart. Your heart. That's what he's after. God is not primarily after your good behavior. God is primarily after your heart. Now, that's an interesting thing just to observe. He's not primarily after your good behavior. He is first and foremost after your heart. Because when you read the New Testament, you find something really interesting. Who behaved the best in Jesus' day? It wasn't the disciples. The people who behaved the best in Jesus' days were the group of people called the Pharisees. They did everything the best. They looked the best. They prayed the best. They knew the most. They served the most. They went to church the most. They fasted the most. They everythinged the most. Right? That's the Pharisees. If you were walking around in the first century in a Jewish community, you would be like, that's the kind of person I want to be one day. I want to be like those guys, the Pharisees. They really were the good guys of the day. They were the moral people, the good people. But what's so interesting is in the New Testament, they get the harshest words from Jesus. The good people get his harshest words. So he says things like this to them in Mark 7. These people, those Pharisees right there, these people honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me. Now, if you were in the first century, you'd be like, there's no way that could be true of them. Those are the good guys, the moral people. They are doing everything the best, and somehow they are worshiping Jesus in vain. Because although they're doing the right things, their heart is not with God. It's not for God. Or in Matthew 23, Jesus says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites." That's a harsh first word. "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which outwardly appear beautiful, but within are full of dead people's bones and uncleanness." He's looking at the good people and saying, hey, those good people, they look really good on the outside, but inside they are corrupt and evil, and it is all bad in there. That's the good people he's talking to. And it's just showing us that God is not primarily concerned with your behavior. Why? Because our behavior can look good even when our heart is bad. You can behave really well even when your heart is a long way from God. It reminds me of the boy that was sitting with his mom in church, and he decided halfway through the service that he was going to stand up. So he just, right there in his seat, he just stands up right in the middle of the sermon. And his mom gives him that scary mom look. And she gives him that scary mom look, and she says, I'm going to, and he doesn't even let that get out. He sits right down. And then he slips her a note a few minutes later that says, "But I'm standing up on the inside." That's why God is after your heart. Because you can be standing or sitting down, but standing up on the inside. You can give God your good behavior without actually giving God your heart. So God is after your heart. Because when God has your heart, he has you. When God has your heart, he's going to have your behavior. Right? When God has your heart, he has the real thing. He has you. This is why when a person walks up to Jesus and he says, Jesus, would you take all the Old Testament laws, like everything you tell your people to do in the Old Testament, and would you just condense it down to one thing? If you had to summarize it all in one thing, what would it be? And Jesus looks back at him and says, here's what it would be. Love the Lord your God with all your heart. That's what God wants. He is after your heart. Because when God has your heart, everything else in the Christian life follows. That's the heart. Okay, now in our text, Proverbs 4, verse 23, in our text, there is a command. Like we are actually to do something now with our heart. And here's the command. Above all else, keep your heart, for everything you do flows from it. That's what we're to do. Keep our hearts. So the question becomes, how do we do that? How do we keep our heart? Keeping your heart is this lifelong work. We're never going to be done with it. Until we see Jesus one day, your work and my work, this is what it means to follow Jesus, is we are keeping our heart. So how do we do that? Well, let me give you the two types of work that are needed to keep your heart. It really comes in two different ways. There's two things we have to do to keep our heart. Here is one way we keep our heart, or one part of heart keeping. We keep our heart by guarding against sin. This is one way that we keep our heart, by guarding against sin. This is why the NIV uses that word guard. It doesn't use the word keep in the NIV. You need to guard your heart. And now think about the posture of guarding. Guarding is defensive by nature, right? To guard something means you are awake. You are aware. You are armed, and you are ready for an evil person to get there to do bad things, and you are there to guard what this good thing is behind you, right? This is the posture of guarding. You're awake, you're armed, you're ready. Jerry Bridges, in his book, Pursuit of Holiness, I think he gives really helpful imagery. He says, let's take your heart for a minute, and let's picture it as a territory. So you've got this vast thing called your heart, and it's pictured as a territory. And right in the middle of the territory of your heart is a big, beautiful castle. Okay, so you get in the picture, your heart, territory. In the middle of the territory is a castle. And before you met Jesus, sin was in the castle and on the throne. It was controlling your heart, Right? This is all of our stories pre-Jesus, before we were converted, before we became a Christian. But then the moment of you becoming a Christian, this is what happens. Sin gets dethroned. It gets kicked out of the castle. Jesus is enthroned. You now have a new heart with a new master, a new king that's in the castle ruling everything in your heart. That's what it means to become a Christian. This is what is happening to you when you become a Christian. But the Bible warns us now. So there's your picture now. Here's what a Christian is. Jesus is in the castle, in the territory of your heart, ruling your heart. But the Bible warns us that although sin was dethroned, it was not destroyed. It's not yet gone away. Although sin no longer reigns in your heart, it still remains in your heart. So one day, we're going to see Jesus face to face, and sin will be eradicated. It's going to be a great day, isn't it? We're going to love that day. But until then, the Bible says, here's what happens with sin. It still remains in you. So sin has retreated from the capital city, retreated from the castles, and it's sort of moved into the jungles of your heart. And from the jungles of your heart, it wages this brutal guerrilla warfare. So now, every day, sin is looking for a way back into the castle, looking for a way to bust through the castle gates, looking for a way to jump over the castle walls. It's just looking for any way it can to get back into the castle, to dethrone Jesus, and to get back on its throne. Every day in your life, that's what's happening. The castle of your heart that is now has Jesus as the reigning king is being assaulted by sin every single day of your life. This is why the Bible looks at Christians and reminds them, you are in a war. You are. Not some of us. If you're a Christian, you are in a war every day of your life. Galatians chapter 5 describes the war. For the desires of the flesh are against the spirit. And the desires of the spirit are against the flesh. For they are opposed to each other to keep you from doing the things you want to do. If you feel that, Galatians 5:17, in your life, it just means you're a normal Christian. If you don't feel that, it means you're either a sick Christian or you're not a Christian. But this is the life of a Christian. There's the desires of the flesh, that sin that's retreated into the jungle of our life and our heart. And then there's the enthroned Jesus, the Spirit of God that lives in us, in the castle. And now these two things are constantly at war. Every day when you wake up to life on the front lines. Every single day. You wake up to life with a real enemy who wants to wreck your life, ruin everything about your life, to burn your life to the ground, and to take from you both now and forever. You've got a real enemy that wants to do that. So what do we do in light of that? Answer, we guard our hearts. That's what we do. Every day of our life, this is the work. We guard our hearts. We stand at the castle gates armed and ready. We patrol the walls around the castle just looking for any little place that sin is trying to break in. This is what we do. We guard our hearts. Friend, you have a real enemy with a real arsenal of temptations that is really trying to wreck your life. So what do? We guard our hearts. We stay watchful for these things. We are guarding against sin. Let me give you three ways to do that work of guarding. If we're going to guard our hearts against sin, three ways to do that. Number one is to know your heart. Guarding is knowing. You have to know your heart. We are all made in the image of God, which means we're all made in very similar ways. There's a lot of commonalities among every one of us in here. We're all made in the image of God. But there is uniqueness to you. There are differences about you than the person sitting beside you, which means temptation that may be really bright in your life to the person beside you, it may be very dull for them. And the temptation that's very bright in their life is really dull to you. So you need to know your heart. Part of what it means to guard your heart is to actually know it. That you have to get to know your heart, your particular wirings, your temperament, your vulnerabilities. So that now, once you know those things, you can now put in the appropriate safeguards. You now know the particular parts of the wall that you need to patrol a lot. The particular gates in the castle that you need to always be on guard against. Some of you have read the Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis, and the book is written in a really peculiar way. It's written from the perspectives of demons who are trying to tempt people. So it's written from kind of the opposite way that we would think a book like that would be written. But I think there is like a screw tape exercise that we all need to think about. If you could just imagine this for a moment. If you were an enemy trying to break into the castle of your heart, how would you try? What part of the wall would you jump over? What is the gate that you would try to break through? I mean, you know you as well as anybody knows you. So you know your own particular vulnerabilities. And so what part of the wall would you try to break through if you were the enemy? You should know that. That would be a great family discussion for you. It'd be a great discussion in your marriage if you're married. It'd be a great discussion in your community group this week. What are the particular vulnerabilities that if I were the person trying to wreck my life that I would try to exploit? This is part of what it means to know your heart. And we guard our heart first by knowing it. Here's the second way we can guard our heart, is we kill sin early. We kill sin early. Picture two trees. Tree number one is a 75-foot tall, I mean, this thing is 65 years old. It is a massive oak tree. I mean, it's got a deep root system. It's got a massive trunk, these huge branches. Picture that oak tree, 75 feet tall. And then picture this oak tree. It's an oak tree, but it's a brand new one. It has just sort of come out of the ground. It's 6 inches tall. It's just got its first leaves on it, that oak tree. And now picture a person coming to you and saying, I need you to uproot that oak tree. You're praying that they mean that little one, right? Because the little one is a one-man job. It's one man, 1 minute, and the little seedling is gone. But if we're talking that big one, it's like, man, I'm going to have to like create a plan here. I'm going to need probably to call in some reinforcements and get some help. I'm going to need a chainsaw. You're going to need all sorts of things. It's going to be all sorts of work to get that big tree taken out, right? Now, lay that over your life. That is the difference between dealing with sin as a seed and dealing with sin as a full-grown tree. And guarding your heart means you are killing sin early when it's a seed. That you're paying attention to the things that are sprouting in your life. That you're paying attention to those little things in your life that given time are going to grow into things that are going to kill you and choke you. We're paying attention to the little things. And this is what makes guarding our heart, in particular, this type of sin-killing work so difficult. Sin is so willing to play the slow game, the long game with you. Sin most often in our life grows very subtly. So slowly that if you're not on guard, you will not even notice it growing. But over time, those roots deepen, those branches get bigger, and then one day that sin that you felt like was just not a big deal grabs you and will not let you go. And that is happening right now in many of our lives. Sin is growing unchecked, unguarded against. And part of what guarding your heart means, keeping your heart means, is you are taking those small things seriously in your life. That you're paying attention to the little things, the little evils, the little sins, the little inconsistencies, the little indiscretions, the little indulgences of the flesh, the little acts of laziness or sloppiness or cowardice, the little drifts from integrity, the little touches of meanness as they come out in your life, the little indifferences to the feelings and the wishes of other people around you, the little outbursts of your temper, the little outbreaks of selfishness and the little outbreaks of pride in your life. This is what you're paying attention to. There is a little note on my desk that I see this note almost every day, just sitting right there on my desk. And the note says this: you're always becoming something, and you need to pay careful attention as to what it is. This is true of you. And the something that you're becoming is really, in large part, determined by what you do with the little things in your life. So pay attention to those little things. This is how we guard our heart. What seemingly small things are happening right now in your life that given time are going to grab you, and when they grab you, they're not going to let you go. Whatever those things are, like today is the day to deal with those things. Sin does not get easier to deal with a week from now or a year from now or a decade from now. It will never be easier than right now to deal with those things. So guarding our hearts means we're going to deal right now with them. Like not tomorrow, but today we're going to kill these things. We kill sin early. And then thirdly, when you're thinking about what does it mean to guard my heart? How do I do that? We need to remember what sin wants. Think about temptation in your life. When temptation shows up to the party, it's always well-dressed and looking good. That's why it's tempting. Right? When sin shows up, it presents as a friend to be enjoyed, not an enemy to be killed. It always shows up that way. So we all need these little sacred moments in our life where we remember, what is sin after? What does it really want? Answer, death. That's what it wants. That's what it wants in your life. That sin that shows up well-dressed, looking good, like a friend to be enjoyed, what it wants for you is death. An old Puritan pastor said it rightly when he said, sin promises like a god, but pays like a devil. James says it rightly when he says, then desire, when it is conceived, gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is fully grown, when the seedling has gone to a tree and now that tree is in your life and the roots of that tree grab you, here is what it's after. And when sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. That sin right now that feels so cute and enjoyable and pleasurable, one day is going to grow into the thing that will absolutely destroy your life. So we need to remember, this is what sin is after. This is what it wants in my life is death. So we have to stay on guard. Friend, are you guarding at the gates of the castle of your hearts? Are you patrolling the wall? Do you know your heart? Are you killing these things early? You're just looking for a rumbling of sin out there somewhere. It's first sort of break from the jungle to the castle and you're meeting it out there. Is this your way of living? This is what keeping your heart means. It means that you are guarding your heart. You're guarding it against sin. Then here's the second thing it means. The second work of keeping your heart. We keep our hearts, yes, by guarding against sin and by cultivating godliness. So when we're keeping our hearts, we're not just guarding against something bad. Here's the main work of keeping your heart. You're cultivating something amazing, something great. That's what you're actually trying to do. You're trying to cultivate something great in your heart. So let's change the imagery of our heart for a moment. Let's move from the territory with the castle, that imagery. And now let's picture your heart as a garden. And in the garden of your heart, we want to grow amazing fruit. We want to grow the fruit of godliness. We want to grow our hearts that are continually in awe of God. We want to grow a love of God, an enjoyment of God in our life. That's the fruit we want to grow in us, right? This is what we want to be happening in our hearts every single day. And to do that, we have to cultivate these things in our heart. So maybe you could think of it this way. To keep your heart means cultivating it. You have to cultivate the garden of your heart. And let me give you two cultivation questions that you should be asking if you want the fruit of godliness to grow in your life. Two cultivation questions. Question one, what needs to be taken out or stopped, needs to be taken out of the garden if I want the garden of my heart to produce great fruit, mature fruit? What are the things that need to be taken out? If you can just picture yourself as a gardener, you're going to be looking all the time at your garden thinking, what needs to be removed here? What weeds need to be pulled? What needs to be taken out of this garden so that the fruit can actually grow? You should be thinking about that in a similar way in your own life. What are the things that need to be taken out of my heart, out of my life, so that the fruit of godliness can grow? When we ask the question in our life of should we do this thing or not do this thing, we often ask the wrong set of questions. You can just test yourself in this. Should I do this? Should I not do this? Here is typically the question that we ask. Well, is that thing sinful? That's the question. Can I do that? Does God give me permission to do that? Do I have the freedom to do that? That's the line of questions that we typically employ when we're like, should I do this or should I not do that? I just want to try to convince you, you shouldn't ask those set of questions. That should not be your main set of questions that you ask. This should be the main question that you ask when you get to a should I or shouldn't I moment. Here's the question. Will this dampen or deepen my desires for God? That's your question. Will this deepen or dampen my desires for Jesus? That's the question we should ask. So if I watch that show, will it dampen or deepen my desires for Jesus? If I spend the last hour of my night watching TV, does that dampen or deepen my desires for Jesus? If I listen to that podcast, does that dampen or deepen my desires for Jesus? If I read that book, does it deepen or dampen my desires for Jesus? If I hang out with those people, does it have a way of dampening my desires for the Lord or deepening my desires for the Lord? Does that social media account and how much I'm on it, is that dampening my desires for God or is it deepening my desires for God? That is the question that a cultivator is asking. Someone who is trying to tend to the garden of their hearts. Is this dampening or deepening my desires for Jesus? Or maybe you could think of it this way. Imagine for a moment that a great meal is spread before you. I don't know what you just pictured, but if it's only vegetables, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Here's what I pictured. A 16-ounce ribeye. To the glory of God. And I'll probably throw some Brussels sprouts on there just because I want to live another day. But that's my meal right there. That's it. And if you just picture your meal, whatever that like, it doesn't get any better than that one right there. Now, if you know that meal is coming at 6 p.m. tonight, can I tell you one thing you're not going to do today? You're not going to stop by Taco Bell at 4 p.m. to grab a few tacos. Why? Because if you do that, you will ruin the meal. It'll make it impossible to be satisfied with the goodness of that steak. Friends, one reason our spiritual appetites wither and sometimes even die within us is because we just keep stuffing ourselves with small things. Thomas Watson, an old Puritan pastor, said it this way. You never knew a man who glutted himself upon the world and at the same time was greatly in love with Christ. You're not going to find that. You're not going to find a person who is eating Taco Bell at all hours of the day who enjoys that steak at 6. And friends, God really is a meal to be enjoyed. And if you want to enjoy that meal, it means you've got to stop some things in your life that are just stuffing your soul with all sorts of sugary candy that feels so good in the moment, but just leaves you more thirsty at the end of it, more hungry when you finish it. So what are the things in your life that are dampening your desires for Jesus? Those are the very things that need to be pulled out of your life. What needs to stop? What needs to be pulled out of your life, taken out of the garden of your heart? And here's the second cultivation question. What are the things that need to be put into the garden of your life, into the garden of your heart? Like what things you need to start? What new habits need to be cultivated in your life? The best way to keep your heart with God is to keep your heart full with God. It's the best way. For your heart to be satisfied in the meal that is God. So how can you do that? What are the things that need to be happening in your life so that your heart is actually full on God? Stuffed with the great thing that is Jesus. What do you need to do that? For your heart to see God, to be satisfied in God. Whatever that is, you just got to keep putting a lot of those things in your life because it really is the key to you walking with the Lord for the long haul. You just got to keep those things that are helping you see God. I love how Ray Ortland says it. He says, we start changing only when we see Christ. How does a human being change? when your heart and your eyes begin to gaze upon and see the beauty that is God. That's how you change. So he says, we start changing only when we see Christ, when we see that Jesus will make us alive in ways that our most darling sins cannot. When we see that in Christ we are losing nothing but our damnation and we're gaining everything we desire in our deepest intentions. The gospel shows us Jesus pouring out his lifeblood so that we can live. The gospel says, look at him, come to him, follow him. And if you do, you'll stop dying and you'll start living, and that living will never come to an end. That's what we want to do. I don't know of anyone in here who wants to keep dying. But I think all of us in here want to stop dying, and we want to start living more and more and more the life that God opens up for us. That's what we want. So we're asking the question now, what would bring my heart to life like that? What is it that helps me see God? What is it that helps deepen my desires for him? What is it that preps me for the meal so that when I sit down with God, my heart can be full on him? Whatever those things are, do those. Those are the things we're adding into our life. And those things that sharpen our spiritual appetites, that help us enjoy more of God, that deepen our desires, we call those spiritual habits or spiritual disciplines. We don't do these things to earn grace. We do these to enjoy God who gives us grace. Right? That's why we do have these spiritual habits or these spiritual disciplines. And this is what we're going to explore together over the next couple of weeks. Some of these core habits that we need in our life if we are going to have our desires deepened for God. And just as a spoiler alert, next week we're going to talk about the Bible. We need the Bible in our life. We need to be in the Bible a lot, exercising that spiritual habit, establishing that spiritual discipline in our life. And I just want to commend this Bible reading plan to you now. It's going to be out in the lobby for you. But it's just a way for you to be able to wake up every day and know exactly what you're reading. You can grab a scripture memory plan out there so you'll know exactly what you're memorizing. It's just a way to help give your life some consistency in the Bible. It's one of those things that need to be in our life if we're going to have our desires deepened for God. So what needs to be added to your life? If you're going to see Jesus, have your heart satisfied in him, enjoying him, what needs to be added to your life? Let me end here. I have been in pastoral ministry now for over 2 decades, and here is one of the things I have learned over my years in ministry. We are never more than about 3 minutes away from absolutely wrecking our lives. We're all uniquely gifted at doing it. No one in here is immune from it. There is a long list of really good men and good women that sin has slain. Burn their lives to the ground. We're never more than 3 minutes away from wrecking our lives. And the road to that wreck is always the same. It's a very consistent, well-worn road that gets us to the wreckage. And here it is. It's the road of an unguarded castle and an uncultivated garden. That's the road that leads to the wreckage. Unguarded and unkept, here's what happens. Our heart grows cold to God. We get bored with the Lord. And when our heart grows cold, our eyes begin to drift and our feet begin to take us places we never thought we'd go. And then we wake up one day in the midst of a life-shattering catastrophe. And you don't have to be evil to wreck your life. You don't have to give yourself to like unvarnished, terrible evil to wreck your life. All you have to do to wreck your life is to have an unguarded castle, an uncultivated garden, an unkept heart. So friend, as we start 2026, can I just encourage you, keep your heart. Keep your heart. Keep looking at Jesus. Keep receiving his grace. Stay on guard. Keep the garden of your heart cultivated. And if you'll do that, you're not going to lose your way. If you do that, you're going to keep walking with God into life and more life and more life. So let's hear these words again from Proverbs 4. My son, Solomon says, be attentive to my words. Incline your ear to my sayings. Let them not escape from your sight. Keep them within your heart, for they are life to those who find them and healing to all their flesh. So above all else, keep your heart, for everything you do flows from it. Why don't you bow with me?